Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
The Tennis Podcast.
The Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, the first tennis podcast that we have brought to you for a few weeks. You've probably heard plenty from us if you follow us on Twitter, on Facebook or on Instagram or one of the many other millions of platforms that David Law is finding out about on a weekly basis, because we have been running our Kickstarter campaign to raise funds to keep this podcast going in 2017. It's going really well. We haven't quite hit the targets yet. There's still a couple of weeks to go before the end of the campaign though, so if you haven't donated yet, then there is still opportunity to, and I'll bring you more details of that later in the show. But don't worry, we're not going to bore you with desperate pleas for your money for a whole show. We are going to talk about some tennis, and to do that I am joined by, well, first of all, Rosie, who's lying at my feet at the moment glaring at the doggy pigs in blankets I've got sat on the table next to me, and secondly, very much second in the running order, David Law. David, how are you doing?
All right, steady. Hello, Rosie. I'm glad you've joined us for our final episode of 2016. I didn't know you were around for this particular episode. And the IQ level has just catapulted into the stratosphere now that you're a part of the team.
I'm trying to teach her how to wink at the moment. She's been doing inadvertent winks. And I'm trying to get her to understand a command for it. It's not going brilliantly. But yeah, I think I've perhaps bitten off more than I can chew with dog training there. But yeah, she's a YouTube sensation waiting to happen. But yeah, she is lying at my feet. How has your Christmas been, David? It has been holiday season. Happy Christmas, happy Hanukkah, happy Eid, happy pagan festival, if you're that way inclined. Happy all the festive times. Have I covered all the bases there? How have your festive times been, David?
They've been fantastic, fantastic. No, it's been a wonderful few weeks, just lounging around, moving basically the radius of my house, and that's about it. And just eating disgusting amounts of food, and really just trying to keep calm until the start of the tennis season, because
you've not been succeeding at staying calm at all. As I said to David just before we came on air, we were just having a little chat. I said, David, it's just been just you, the family and the Twitter sphere, because David has been going, in the absence of any actual tennis to watch, you've been going particularly nuts on Twitter, to the extent that I've actually had to turn off my notifications for both the David Law tennis account and the tennis podcast account, which I'm not ashamed to admit it, you know, girl's got to have a break from the pole vault. But that is the only mention of pole vault on today's show, because I'm presenting, so we're going to move straight on, because considering it's been the off-season, the already incredibly brief off-season that we have in tennis, an absurd amount has happened in the tennis world, hasn't it, David? It's been quite extraordinary. Some of it good, some of it mixed, some of it incredibly bad. And we'll get perhaps the really, really bad out of the way first. And that probably the worst of it all has to be the attack that Petra Kvitova sustained at her home in the Czech Republic, and the subsequent injury that has been caused to her left hand, of course, her dominant playing hand. I'm not sure Provided everybody knows the details of that, and they were very widely reported, there's not a whole lot for us to say. I mean, the bottom line is everybody knows and can draw their own conclusions. It's just a terrible, terrible, unfortunate thing. Her response to it has been heartwarming and fantastic and incredibly stoical. And it sounds like the best projected schedule of her recovery is that she might be able to try and hold a tennis racket in 3 months and might be able to start playing again in roughly 6 months. That is definitely the most optimistic schedule. I think there's a whole lot of unknowns in that at the moment. She did sustain nerve damage, which to me sounds worrying, but equally, you know, she had some of the best surgeons in the Czech Republic working on her, and she certainly, it seems, sees reason to be optimistic. That press conference she did just under a week ago, just before Christmas, was quite extraordinary, wasn't it, David, in terms of her attitude to the whole thing just days after it happened. I mean, she could have been forgiven, it could have been understandable if she was still just walking around in a completely catatonic state, frankly, you know, still in shock from it all. Yet she seemed to have digested everything that had happened to her, everything that possibly could happen to her over the next few months and years. She seemed to just have been taking it on board in the most measured, level-headed way imaginable.
Yeah, in a manner in which I can barely fathom. I do not see how I would possibly cope with an event like that in the way that she has. I have unending admiration for her in that regard. I feel terribly sorry for her that this has happened, like we all do, because, I mean, just the shock must be total at the time, and the fear and everything else that goes with it. But, well, as you said, there's not much to say other than it's a terrible shame that it's put her out of the sport and caused her such harm on a physical and personal level. But also, you know, thank goodness that she's still here to tell the tale and that it's not even worse than it was. And we wish her the very best and hope she's back very, very soon.
Yeah, that's just it, isn't it? It's awful. It's undeniably awful, but it could have been worse. And if Petra Kvitova herself can see the positives in the situation, then we certainly should be able to as well. So, yeah, absolutely, very well said. She will, of course, be missing from the Australian Open, and she won't be the only one missing from the Australian Open. Well, she did. There's actually a worryingly growing list of big, interesting names that we're not going to see at the Australian Open. It hasn't dampened your excitement. That much is certain.
Just 0.01%, that's 0.0, it.
An immeasurable... God, imagine what the Twitter activity would be like with that extra 0.01%. Rosie, actually, as I speak, is edging towards the door. It is 47 minutes until... No, it is 37 minutes until her dinner time, so she's getting a bit edgy. The countdown is on. Yeah, others that will be missing from the Australian Open. Juan Martín Del Potro, he's not going to play. Really devastating, isn't it? Not due to any... Well, he says he hasn't had enough time to recover from last season, and he simply says his body won't allow him to play a full schedule of tennis ever again, it sounds like. So he has to make difficult decisions and be selective about where he plays. But that's a tough way to start the year by missing the first Grand Slams. Madison Keys won't be there. She is going to have some surgery. She, incidentally, has also announced that she's back with Lindsay Davenport, which I think is a great thing. More on the coaching merry-go-round shortly. Victoria Azarenka has had a baby. We knew she was having a baby. We knew she wouldn't be in Australia, but there you go. Congratulations to Victoria Azarenka. And Anna Vanovic, it has retired as of 24 hours ago, so we won't be seeing Aussie Anna there either. That's quite a list. That's quite a bombardment of information I'm going to give you to comment on now, David.
And it is a bit of a who's who of good eggs, isn't it? If you think of some of the players you've just named there, Anna Ivanovic, Juan Martín Del Potro, Keys, Azarenka, these are good people as well, that very decent for us to deal with in the media. And yeah, it's going to be a shame not to have them there, and Kvitova obviously at the top of that list. But Ivanovic, the news about her coming out yesterday, she prefaced it 24 hours earlier by saying she was going to hold a Facebook Live session, something that Catherine Whittaker is particularly good at. You'll be able to see that during the Australian Open on Eurosport's account, no doubt, Catherine.
Daily, informed daily.
Daily. Goodness me! Well, how are you going to fit in periscopes for us then, if we manage to get there and do them? Anyway,
I'm going to be doing
that's
them over
story.
Breakfast, I think.
Yeah, exactly right. Anna Ivanovic did this yesterday, and certainly for me, it was not a surprise. Partly because I'd had a few conversations with Nigel Sears. I knew that they were not going to be working together anymore after the final event of 2016. And certainly the feeling I got was that the decision had been pretty much made by Ivanovic a short while ago, and that she was just disillusioned with the way her body was responding with all the injuries and the rigors of the tour. I mean, let's not forget, this is somebody who's been around for more than 10 years because she started as a teenager. She'd reached the pinnacle of the game. She was world number one. She was a French Open champion 8 years ago. This is a long time ago. And yes, she's had flashes of inspiration reaching the French Open semis in 2015 and moments where you thought, actually, maybe she could still become a force at the very top end of the game, but hasn't ever been able to sustain it for the last few years, really. And I think I don't know her very well, but she seems really nice. I've never heard a bad word said about her. I think she'll have a very happy life without tennis. She seems to have a lot of interest. She's just got married. I suspect she will be somebody who does a lot with her life in the future. But she is only 29. It is a shame that she's retired. But the mind does go back a year to conversations I had with Nigel about the level she was still playing at, certainly in practice, and it was he believed it to be a really high level. He felt that she, if she could put that level onto the court consistently, she could compete at the very top level again. But two things: one, the injuries she's talked about, and two, if you watched her on court in the last few years, you could see anxiety was an issue for her, performance anxiety. She would want to win so badly, too badly, and it would end up impeding her performance, and she could no longer handle it. And I actually read an interview with her just yesterday on the WTA site, where she was talking about how when she was younger, she was just winning almost as though, and wasn't even thinking about it. There was the older you get, we've talked about this before, the older players get, the more the nerve goes, and they start to remember difficult experiences in their career when they're standing there about to serve break point down or whatever it might be, and I think she's a perfect example of that. She struggled more of it with it as the years went by. But
well, there's just you're taking more baggage, aren't you, onto the court?
That's right. That's right. And lots to remember, though, in a very positive way about Anna Ivanovic. I think I asked her on Twitter yesterday or the day before whether she'd realised her potential, and I think she did. I mean, and don't forget, obviously, potential, the mental side of it comes into that, and I think she did what she could with what she'd got. She put everything into it.
It's funny, isn't it? Can you think of just that account you've recalled of her talking about the anxiety that she brought onto the court in that years? I'm thinking aloud here, David, which is sort of what the podcast is for, I suppose. Can you think of any examples of players that actually developed more nerve as they got older? Is that just an inevitable thing, or is it a personality related thing that tends to be normal, but there are some that buck the trend? I'm putting you right on the spot here, David.
I would say Jo Konta, for one. I mean, I know she's only 25, but if you went back to when she was 20, she's trained herself to handle her nerves, and she's become sort of a mental giant in the women's circuit in the last 12 to 18 months, and yet she was the total opposite to that a few years ago. I think there are other players who've just learned from their experiences and maybe have gone away and consulted the right sports psychologist for them, that has said something maybe in the latter stages of the career that has just clicked. Somebody I would think of in terms of achieving his goals is someone like Marin Cilic, who I think his click was Goran Ivanišević. He just managed to get him to relax and to stop overthinking it. So I do think it's possible, and that's why I think Tomas Berdych is such an interesting story over the next 12 months. He was talking in an interview yesterday about no longer being concerned with being consistent over the full 12 months. He wants to have that one standout event above all else. He wants a slam. He wants to put it together and relax and spice up his career. And, of course, he's added Goran.
Yeah, well, I remember talking to Tomas Berdych. We're getting way off piste here. None of this is in the agenda, but there you go. I remember talking to Tomas Berdych in one of the clay court tournaments last year, and I said, oh, you have the most consistent record on the tour. You're the only player that's reached the quarterfinals or better of every tournament. You know, I was trying to butter him up for a hard-hitting question, you know, and he just wasn't impressed with that at all. He wasn't biting in any way. He wasn't, you know, it was clear that, you know, that's not the goal for him. Quarterfinals or better. What does that mean to Tomas Berdych? He's done that now. If it's not a slam, then it's not worth having. I remember my ice skating coach used to say to me that stupid skaters, she said I was too intelligent to be a skater because I thought about it all too much. Every time I went round to do a jump, she could see on my face that I was thinking about all the times I'd ever fallen trying to do that jump before. And she said she had, you know, she didn't name them, but stupid or less intelligent people that she coached who just could merrily go round and, you know, just not think about it all too much. And maybe that's the key, whether it's via stupidity or via, you know, hiring a sports psychologist or a coach that can just somehow tap in. And I know there's all this sort of my instinct with people that talk about staying in the present. I sort of instantly wince at all that sort of psychobabble type stuff. But does seem to work, doesn't it? Does seem to work. That does seem to be what it's about, staying in the present and not thinking about all your baggage. And, yeah, as much as staying in the present sounds to me like a whole load of hot air, you know, I'm not a top-level athlete. And you can't knock it. It seems to, if you can find the key to be able to do it, it does seem to be what works.
Indeed. Well, I'll tell you what, I've realised now, Catherine, hearing all that, and particularly from your ice skating coach, who's revealed something to me about your intelligence, which I certainly hadn't cottoned on to, about you being too intelligent.
I should probably preface that before it sounds like the worst humble brag of all time. I mean, it already sounds like that, I'm aware. Dave, I'm expecting the text from Dave Levy to come through any minute now. That I don't think her reference points for... I don't think the bar was that high. I think I can...
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all becoming clear to me now, though, that the reason my tennis career hasn't taken off is just because I'm just too much of a boffin.
Sure. Yeah, that's what it is. I'd like to see you say that to John McEnroe one day. You know, I think the key to your success, John, was that you just weren't that intelligent.
No problem. Moving on,
should we get back to the agenda topics?
Oh, yeah, go on then.
Would you like to say anything about Madison Keys, her getting back together with Lindsay Davenport? Now is your time, David, if you'd like to.
I am disappointed about Keys. I mean, I at the WTA finals, she just always feels as though she's improving, and this is just a setback. You know, just you feel as though this woman, sooner or later, is going to be the one to take it over with the game she's got. And this could have been a perfect tournament for her. It was 2 years ago, wasn't it, when she reached the semi-finals and had that big breakthrough. Davenport was by her side then. I think that they mesh very well together as personalities, certainly. Seeing her with Thomas Hogstad on the side of the court and listening into their on-court coaching sessions, you got the feeling that it was a very business-like relationship. It worked. He got her into the top 10. It's a big move, actually, for Keys to move away from him, really. But there's clearly a comfort level with Davenport, and I can understand it. She's a very easy person to get along with. Plus, been there, done it with a very similar game. Hopefully her physical side can stand up in the future, but that is a blow. Del Potro, I know that, you know, the point you made about him saying that his body can't handle a full year, I hope it is that. I hope it is that, because who knows? Maybe there's been another relapse of some kind.
No,
with the
I can't even think about that as a possibility, Dave. It's too bleak.
Yeah.
It's too.
Well,
I mean, we can't take it. We've all invested so much
in
the fairy tale Del Potro's story. It cannot be.
Yeah, in this rubbish year of 2016, in so many ways, he was a shining light. And well, let's hope he's back soon. I hope they're all back soon.
David the Optimist. Right then. Well, that brings us nicely on to talk of the ever-rotating coaching merry-go-round. We've mentioned
Madison
Keys.
Oh, we haven't talked about Roger Federer's return yet.
Yeah, well, no, I've decided to just, because I'm in control, I'm going to rejig. I thought that was a nice segue.
Go on then.
Because we've already mentioned coaching changes. I thought I was doing some on-the-hoof rejigging, which I thought worked really well until you drew attention to it. Anyway.
Rejig away.
There has been lots of movement in the world of coaches, hasn't there, David? Some very, very intriguing movement. Probably the least intriguing, because we had already talked it to death before it had even happened. Boris Becker and Novak Djokovic have fully confirmed their split since the last time that we spoke. It's no great surprise. Becker, who'll be working with Eurosport at the Australian Open, actually, he just can't stay away for long, can he? He has said some interesting stuff post the split about how he didn't think Djokovic worked hard enough in the second half of last year. I suppose that's not that revelatory. I suppose most people probably would have assessed that that was likely to be the case. But the fact that Becker's, you know, been that outspoken about it, I suppose it is interesting. But yeah, I mean, we have sort of done it to death, haven't we? But have you anything to add, David?
It did amuse me. I thought that was an interesting interview he gave, by the way, revealing that level of detail. I don't think he necessarily intended to at the time, but he was pushed quite hard by Jackie Beltrán on Sky in a follow-up question, and lo and behold, he ended up saying it. I found it quite amusing that within an hour of announcing or the departure from Djokovic's team, there was a picture released by Eurosport of him standing there with his Eurosport microphone. I mean, they don't hang about. He doesn't hang about, does he?
But I suspect that deal didn't come about within that hour.
Imagine if it right, Boris. You know, you've just stopped working with Novak. Get yourself a pink shirt on.
I mean, it could have done.
Hold this microphone and have this photo taken. Deal? We all right? Yeah, fine. £5.
I think it's probably fair to say that Boris doesn't mind being in the spotlight. Do you think that would be?
I think that's fairly accurate. Look,
yeah.
He loves it. This is the thing that we've noticed with all these super coaches. They've missed it. I think it wasn't the done thing. I know they've been commentating and so forth, but there's some people who just don't want to be away, and he's one of them. What am I hearing there?
You are hearing a small cuddly reindeer being being squeaked in exuberance, but not by me, by a dog.
I see.
Yeah, so Becker and Djokovic, no big surprises there. We have sort of, we'd pre-talked it to death. It's going to be interesting. There have been no signs. I've heard nothing on the grapevine about Djokovic potentially hiring someone else. He, of course, still has Marion Vida in his corner. Whether he's looking to make any other appointments, I genuinely don't know. Speak now, David, if you have some insider information. I don't think anybody does. I hear silence.
No,
so
I'm all out. I mean, I think he will work with Marion Vida. It's going to be fascinating. I do love this time of year. I think more than ever now, we get more coaching changes than ever. And I'm sure it's super coach driven in many ways. People just looking for that little edge. And it does make going into Australia just fascinating to see what will happen, who will have the biggest impact.
Well, of course, all eyes are on Carlos Moya and Rafael Nadal, their new coaching relationship, Milos Raonic and Richard Krajicek as well. We'll come on to talk about those in a minute. Just going back to the women's game, because we already mentioned Madison Keys working with Lindsay Davenport. She was working with Thomas Hogstead previously. Jeannie Bouchard is now back working with Thomas Hogstead. She's done various different interviews saying she's targeting 2017 as her year to get back on track to where she was a couple of years ago. Well, of course she is. Why wouldn't you be? You've got to think positive. And of course, Joe Konta as well. Big surprise, big shocks in her coaching team. Not only the split with Esteban Carril, the coach, the Spanish coach she's been working with for the past couple of years, but also the very, very sad news of the death of her mental coach, Juan Cotto, who had been credited with so much of Joe Konta's turnaround over the last couple of years. Konta now is working with new coach Wim Fissett, but it's an awful lot of upheaval, of change. As great a coach as Fissett is, these are turbulent times for Joe Konta, aren't they, David?
Well, it's a big question mark, isn't it, as to how she will come out over the next 12 months, given the upheaval, given the changes. And as you mentioned, first and foremost, somebody who she would have confided in, somebody she believed in Juan Cotto, and who helped her. We talked about her earlier in the podcast on this occasion, how she's changed for the better over the last couple of years, and the way she's transformed her mental approach, and in no small part to the work that she did with him. I remember we had him as a guest on Five Lives coverage of the Australian Open last year, and it would have been a huge blow to her, obviously on a personal level, to suffer such a loss, and we're terribly sad to hear about that ourselves here. And the other side of it, to split with Esteban Carril, who had been with her for the last couple of years and helped to guide her into the world's top 10. I mean, it's, don't know the full details. There are only so many elements given by Konta and Carril as to why the split took place. But to me, it's a big question mark, and I don't know which way this one's going to go, because whenever he came out onto the court, she seemed to respond well to him, relaxed her. Wim Fissett is somebody who's been there and done it with Victoria Azarenka. He's worked with Simona Halep, Kim Clijsters. This is somebody
who has...
You're
going for Fissett, I hear. Sorry. Is very important
we'll
to us
that.
Here on the tennis podcast. Do you say Fissett with authority? Because if so, I will switch up.
I get a lot wrong, so I wouldn't guarantee that that's correct. But anyway, we'll go with that for the sake of argument. If anybody wants to argue with that, but you know, it's a gamble, really, Catherine. I think I'm amazed that she split from Esteban Carril personally. Now, it may turn out to be a masterstroke. She may go from 10 in the world to 5 in the world to Grand Slam champion. She's capable. She's capable, but. Oh dear, I'm surprised, I must say.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm nervous for Joe Konta at this particular moment in time. Obviously, the Juan Cotto thing, terribly sad, and obviously unavoidable from her perspective. The fact that she won't have him in her life anymore. I think the influence has been undoubtable over the last couple of years. But the Carril thing. Yeah, with Joe Konta, we've talked about it a lot over the last year or so, haven't we? That it just seemed like she miraculously managed to find a way for all the pieces of the jigsaw just to fit into exactly the right place all at the same time. And we felt like maybe they're not held in place by anything particularly strong. You know, if one thing goes, then the whole thing could come tumbling down like a house of cards. I've used far too many metaphors in one sentence. But yeah, I just worry that something I thought something, you know, relatively small in the change of her setup could completely upset the apple cart for her. So something this big, of course it could take her to greater success. Of course it could. We don't know. But I'm just a bit nervous for her. She's proved me wrong before, though. I didn't think she'd make it into the top 10 this year. And she's proven me completely wrong. So what do I know? But I'm just a little bit anxious for her at this moment, especially with, you know, the points she has to defend in Australia coming up. You know, mentally, talk about baggage coming onto a court. That's pressure, isn't it? As much as I'm quite sure she will tell us all in Australia how she's staying in the present and she's not thinking about last year and she's not thinking about the point she has to defend. She's not a machine. She's not a robot. That will be somewhere in her mind, and it will be something she'll have to deal with. And I, it all remains to be seen for Joe Konta at the moment. But we will see in the coming weeks, because amazingly, the 2017 tennis season is just days away, and David,
it's awesome, isn't it?
David was at risk of exploding.
I've got Abu Dhabi on right now on Eurosport 2. David
Good
Goffin
channel
against
that Eurosport 2, David. Good channel. Yeah.
Well, you know, David Goffin against Joe Wilfried Tsonga at the moment, going through their paces in what is basically an exhibition, isn't it? But Rafael Nadal was on there earlier. I heard he got a 6-love set against Thomas Berdych. I don't know how that one ended up. But anyway,
That's a pride breather, isn't it? Isn't there a sort of unwritten rule in exhibitions that you're not allowed to get six love sets?
Yeah,
I think Thomas Berdych is probably licking some wounds and feeling a little bit aggrieved somewhere right now.
Could you imagine how that conversation would go, though? Rafa, it's an exhibition, so, you know, don't go all out on every point. I mean, that's like trying to rewire a car, isn't it? It's not going to happen.
Problem is, though, and he's got particularly something to prove at the moment because, drumroll, he's got Carlos Moya in his corner. I haven't heard anybody with anything but positive, excited things to say about the fact that finally we are going to see Moya working with Nadal. I don't expect you to have anything but positive, excited things to say, David.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, actually, Carlos Moya. I mean, it certainly would appear on the surface to be a perfect fit, really. Those two, they get along famously. They used to play each other. All the ingredients are there, but you don't necessarily get the results just because you get along, do you? I mean, and because your stars are similar. Obviously, Moya is a former world number one and French Open champion himself. I just think back to when Moya worked with Raonic, and that seemed a pretty unlikely combination to me, and yet they worked beautifully together. They got some fantastic results. He got him going to the net more than he did the rest of the year, even Carlos Moya. If you remember back to the Australian Open, he was fantastic, I thought, Carlos Moya with him.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I completely agree with you. I don't think it's necessarily about their styles being similar or them getting on really well. I'm sure all of that, or certainly the getting on really well, the fact that he will just mesh seamlessly into the team, I'm sure that will be of great benefit. But isn't it more just about a different voice? Because Nadal's never had a different voice. He's had Uncle Tony.
I think, and
that's what John McEnroe was saying earlier this year, wasn't it? He didn't say who or what kind of person he thought Nadal should bring on board. He just said he thinks he needs somebody to bring something different, to bring a different perspective. And I think when you've worked with somebody for your whole career, your whole life, like Nadal has, let alone the fact that they're a member of your family, it must be quite difficult to accept anything that anybody else has to say. You know, they've been in the same groove for 20-odd years, haven't they?
Yeah.
So I think it possibly needs to be somebody as trusted as Moya, as close as Moya is to Nadal, for him to be prepared to listen to it, perhaps even for Uncle Tony to be prepared to have another voice in the team. You know, the fact that their family will mean that Rafa is particularly respectful and sensitive of Uncle Tony's feelings about the whole matter. So I think it's just about a different voice coming in that Nadal and Tony will be prepared to listen to and take on board.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think it's the right decision for Nadal, because I'm a big believer in leaving no stone unturned. The last thing you would want to do if you're Nadal is have had it in the back of your mind to try this and not have done it and not have had the success without having done it. At least if it goes wrong now, he's tried everything.
Absolutely. Well, what do we make of Milos Raonic and Richard Krajicek then? Speaking of people that used to work with Carlos Moya, Richard Krajicek, of course, trialled some coaching with Stanislas Wawrinka over the grass court season. He made very clear to us, didn't he, at Queen's earlier this year, how it was a really revealing interview, I thought, just how desperate he was to get on the super coach bandwagon. He said he'd been waiting for his kids to leave home so that he could take up a full-time coaching job. You know, he'd been sat by the phone waiting for it to ring. He said he stayed up all night last winter watching every match of the Australian Opens, just from a coach's perspective, trying to sort of get himself in the mindset of a coach. He's desperate to get out there and make a long-term coaching relationship work, I think. And this one, it's interesting to me because it's the total opposite of the Raonic-Moya relationship. They strike me as very similar, Krajicek and Raonic. So of course he had McEnroe with him, Raonic, and I suppose they're more similar in terms of playing styles with the sort of propensity to go up to the net, but in terms of temperaments, completely different. And I felt you could see the instant benefit of that to Raonic. You could see him coming out of his shell by the day at Queens, you know, when they first worked together. I don't think that's going to happen with Krajicek, but I don't know quite what is going to happen with Krajicek on board.
Well, they're very similar. They are very similar individuals. I've spent quite a lot of time with both of those two. They're both deep thinkers, both highly intelligent, fascinated, I think, they will be with each other. I could imagine them spending hours having conversations about all manner of aspects of life, not just tennis. And most specifically, though, given their respective builds are so similar, both tall, rangy men with huge serves, I think Krajicek will have a number of just straightforward tips for Raonic about how best to utilise his game, the game of a big guy. Let's not forget, Krajicek was terrible at Wimbledon, and he figured it out. He worked out how to win Wimbledon in 1996. He has wanted to coach Raonic, I reckon, for 2 or 3 years. I think he's had his eye on him because I remember being in a commentary box with Richard Krajicek on the BBC radio for the quarterfinal of Wimbledon 2 or 3 years ago when Raonic beat Nishikori. And during that commentary, Krajicek said, "This guy is going to win Wimbledon." And I think he even meant that year. And as it happens, he then went out on court against Roger Federer on that dusty, sunburned court when everybody was slipping over and Federer was just tiptoeing around it in the way that he does with that perfect footwork. And frankly, Milos Raonic froze on that day. But again, this year, I think Krajicek watched the run of Raonic and he said in our interview on the eve of the final, he won't win it this year, but he will win it in the next 2 or 3 years, and he'll be a contender for the next 5 or 6. And he believes in
him. With my help.
Yeah, I think he was hoping. I think he was really hoping, and it very nearly happened earlier last year. They did talk, and they worked together for a couple of days and talked about getting together. And I know both of them are really excited about this.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. As I say, at Queens last year, Krajicek was just so delighted to be there and be in a coaching role, wasn't he? He basically said he'd been sat by the phone waiting for a duty call to come in. So I'm really pleased for him. I hope it works for them. But as I say, it's a very different appointment to any that Raonic has made previously. But he does strike me as a guy that is quite open-minded and willing to try anything. You know, we can quote again his Milos Raonic, "I'm CEO of Milos Raonic Tennis." You know, he brings on board consultants, doesn't he? And he remains the overall decision maker. But we say it every off-season, don't we? It makes for a very interesting Australian Open when we have all these new relationships to analyse. You know, all us journalists are scrambling to get down to the practice courts to see what their dynamics are like, you know, how one new coach interacts with another, you know, how did Lendl interact with Jamie Delgado when he came on board at Queens, you know, how are Uncle Tony and Carlos Moya going to get on together? There's no shortage of intrigue. And speaking of intrigue on the practice court, this is another accidental excellent segue, though I say so myself. I thought I would draw attention to it just in case you didn't this time.
I see Rosie's raising her eyebrow.
No, she's actually
there.
Gone off to just sit by her bowl waiting for some food to be poured into it. That's how she, for the 15 minutes before 5 o'clock, she just sits by her bowl just to make sure no one forgets.
She and I have got a lot in common.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
So, to get back to my really excellent segue, Roger Federer is on the cusp of returning to competitive tennis, isn't he? He's in Perth. They didn't sell tickets, I don't think. They just made tickets available on the centre court in Perth today for his practice session. And it looked like a One Direction concert. It was insane. He did a periscope of his practice session in Dubai about a week ago, which my brother pretty much bunked off work to watch. And then we watched again on Christmas Day via Chromecast on our TV, because that's what losers we all are. But it was so interesting. It was so interesting. I wish more players would do that. If you haven't seen it and you're a tennis fan, even if you're not a Roger Federer fan, it's not really about Federer. I just found it really interesting seeing all the drills. He was mic'd up and it was all properly produced. You know, it was a multi-camera shoot. He was hitting with Luca Pui, who was nothing more than a sort of a prop for Federer. And he did a periscope. He did a Q&A session at the end of it, and he couldn't keep track of it. The questions were flooding in so quickly he couldn't keep track of them. And of course, some of them were more insane than others, such as the world of the internet. But some of them were so interesting. And, you know, my dad was particularly interested because he was talking about how many strings he gets through in a year. And my dad does racket stringing. He was just, you know, Christmas Day, we were all sat there glued to the telly watching Roger Federer do a Q&A on the internet. It's great. I really recommend you watch it. And it's just an example of, I know people evangelize so much about how amazing Roger Federer is, and it can become boring. It really can. If you're not a Roger Federer fan to the extent that, you know, my brother is or whatever, I understand that it can become boring. But when you see him do things like that, however boring it all might sound, it is all true. He is so good for tennis. I thought it was fantastic him doing that. Fantastic to see people queue up in frenzy to watch a practice session. You know, that's the frenzy that's surrounding his return. And I think it's all just fantastic. I really do. It's really got me going.
One thing I would say, you said it's not just about Federer, the fact that he did this practice session, that you'd like the insights of a number of the players. I think, though, he does make it different because he gives you such insight. He's so up for it. He's so excited himself. I mean, he is 35 years of age, and he, apart from being a bit more suave and worldly and obviously a good bit more rich and having loads of Grand Slam titles, he just hasn't changed a bit, really, since he was a teenager, in terms of his just sheer delight and happiness that he is a professional tennis player.
He looked giddy with excitement just to be out there on the practice court.
He walked around the practice court looking like he couldn't believe his luck, that this is what he gets to do for a living.
And that's what you want to see, isn't it? That's, you know, for all of us, well, Probably exempt you and I from that, David, who feel just as giddy with excitement when we get to do our day jobs. But a lot of people, you know, would look at him and think, how can you ever complain about anything? That's exactly how you ought to feel. You know, that's just the best life imaginable. And he looks exactly how you want someone to look in his position in the world. Like, basically, everything's just great. And he was just enjoying the whole experience so much. He was being so insightful, you know, talking about why he does every little drill that he does, you know, what aspect of his game he feels it improves, you know, talking about how he felt like it was the serve which suffered most quickly from being away from the game and took the longest to come back. I found that very interesting, talking about the process of rehabilitation of his knee, how long it took for him to not be in pain. And then there was a long period when he wasn't in pain, but he was definitely aware of the knee. And my dad, who's actually had the exact same surgery as Roger Federer, is in that phase at the moment. He's not in pain, but he's aware of it. And he found it very reassuring to hear Federer say that sort of after it took about 4 or 5 months after the pain went for him to stop being aware of it. And he now no longer feels it at all. So that was cheering news for the Whittaker family on Christmas Day. Thank you, Roger Federer. Yeah, it was all just really, really interesting. And yeah, we all benefit from Roger. He doesn't have to do things like that. You know, yeah, I know it's good for his PR, and I'm sure there was all sorts of PR people behind it and everything, but he still doesn't have to do that. And he doesn't have to do it with as much, you know, gusto as he does. And it's all just great for tennis. I sound like you, David.
It's rubbing off, isn't it?
I'm choking
Catherine?
On being this enthusiastic about anything.
I tell you, it's only taken me 5 years to get my what people know me call my chirp chip, because I'm chirping. You know,
you are relentlessly chirpy, David, and you're not going to get less chirpy. It's after a sad start to the podcast. I'm glad I got the sort of less happy news out of the way first, because it's all good now. It's all good. Andy Murray won Sports Personality of the Year. It feels like a million years ago, but we have to at least mention it. I know he was the odds-on favourite, and it was no great surprise, but, you know, it was nice, wasn't it?
It was nice. I nice little bit of name drop. I was there. I was there in he wasn't, but I was. I was in the arena.
We couldn't get Andy Murray, guys, but it's okay. We got David Law.
Well, exactly. That's why everybody seemed okay with it.
Michael Phelps was there.
Yeah, it was quite funny on the big screen, though, when they did present him the award. And well done, Lennox Lewis, for getting it right this time, timings wise. But it was hilarious as the people in their swimming, their bathing costumes were all.
Could they not have asked them to move out of shot just for a couple of minutes?
Come on, that.
Do you think they did ask them and they belligerently refused? They said, no, I'm going to continue sunbathing.
I'd have been trying to get my head in there. I would move,
yeah, because I don't think I would want to be in the background of Andy Murray getting his Sports Personality of the Year award.
Oh, sort of just great.
Lounging around. Yeah, it's a very tricky thing, isn't it, when someone that's not there wins. They definitely improved the situation with the delay on the line. They'd obviously resolved that that was something that had to be improved on last time, and it was all a bit of a disaster. But still, there was a slightly awkward moment when Lennox Lewis sort of handed over the trophy and then didn't really know what to do with himself, so just kept on standing there.
Well, he was so focused on that bit, wasn't he, that he didn't want to get that bit wrong, and he did it as soon as he possibly could. And then
Murray did his speech, which I think he did very well with, and then the credits started rolling, and there was obviously a producer standing behind the camera saying, just keep smiling, Andy.
Keep smiling. Keep looking like an idiot. It's fine.
Don't blink. Just keep smiling. And bless him, he did what he was told, but he didn't look. It wasn't the most natural of smiles, was it? He looked like I would have done in that scenario with someone shouting at me to smile. I did find it slightly amusing. But I'm pleased that he won, but I almost felt like there should be like a separate Andy Murray award, which they should give to him every year for being, I believe, the greatest sports person we've ever had in this country. And then the Sports Personality Award can be, you know, let someone else have a go. It should be there, like, Andy, you're a given. This one's for the best of the rest.
Catherine Whittaker, solving the world's problems in one podcast.
Oh, wow. That's a podcast in itself. This is how ideas are born, David. This is how ideas are born.
Isn't it? I can see Rose is really getting a bit irritated now, isn't
no,
she?
No,
we've definitely gone to 5:01 now.
She's in heaven. She's in heaven. She's eating. I can hear the sound of her munching away in the background. That'll be over in about 14 seconds after she's inhaled it. But yeah, this has been the Tennis Podcast, which leaves me only, I suppose, to do a little bit of a reminder. I know I reminded you at the start of the show that we are running a Kickstarter campaign. If you haven't heard about it, if you, like me, have turned off all of your Twitter and social media notifications for the festive period because you're just feeling a bit grumpy about it all, then we are running a Kickstarter fundraising campaign to help us try and keep the Tennis Podcast going for 2017. It's not that we don't want to keep it going. We love doing it. We really do. It just costs time, money, effort, all of it to keep it going. It doesn't just happen. As much as we enjoy it, we have busy and demanding lives, and it isn't something we can just pluck out of thin air every week. So we need a bit of help to keep it going, a bit of financial help to get editors on board to help us with that sort of thing, people to help us with all the social media, which we know you love so much. So if you are haven't already, if you have chipped in, we thank you very, very much. And we have been pretty overwhelmed with the support we've received. We really have. It's difficult when you start something like this. We've never done anything like it before. We sought advice from other podcasters and similar ventures, one of which is Racket Magazine, who are bringing out a new issue very, very soon. And we like to show solidarity with other people that are doing similar things and doing them from the same place, you know, from love of tennis. We sought advice, but it's difficult when you start something like this and you just don't know what the response is going to be. But we've been really overwhelmed. And if there's anybody listening that hasn't chipped in yet but thinks they might be able to, then we'd be very grateful, wouldn't we, David?
We certainly would. You know, it's been really, I don't want to get too dewy-eyed about it, but it's been quite heartwarming to see how many people that listen to this show have wanted to keep it going and have supported us so far. There's 2 weeks left. If you want to do so, please do kickstarter.com, search for Tennis Podcast, and it'll all be there. Catherine was mentioning Racket Magazine just then, as she said. Issue number 2 is due to come out onto the bookshelves for them. It's also available on racketmag.com, so go and have a look at that. Great magazine. And Catherine, you know, it's only about 3 days until the tennis season starts. It's 2 weeks until the Australian Open.
You are going to explode, aren't you?
I might.
The first ever tennis podcast to end with the spontaneous explosion or implosion of David Law.
Yeah, well, I'm trying really hard to keep the heartbeat normal at the moment. I should say as well, we're also hoping to do daily podcasts at the Grand Slams this year. That's a bit above our target. We've got to fund a bit more for that. So if you want to have daily shows from the Grand Slams, get over there, Kickstarter.
Yeah, we're not threatening you or anything, but if you don't back us, then you might not get daily shows from the Australian Open. But we'd really like to, wouldn't we? We'd really like to. So, just back us if you can. We'd be really grateful. But don't worry, we still love doing the Tennis Podcast, and we'll be back with you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.